All
your
right, here we go.
ophthalmologist this with
Here we
this. Yes.
go. Here we go. So, Jared, at your disposal, or do we need preliminaries?
So a lot of the stuff I'll definitely add in terms of kind of post-production. But yeah, let's just kind of do a quick like overview of context of why we're chatting and a little bit of a roadmap, and then we can kind of dive right in. So yeah, on my end, a number of months back now, I gave the Cobb and Friends presentation looking at process and Neoplatonic metaphysics, and after that, presentation and conversation, Tandeka reached out to me, and we had a little bit of back and forth about Plotinus and the no-thingness of God, and it just seemed like such a rich possible topic that I knew I wanted to yeah have a little bit more of a thorough conversation and hopefully share that out with a wider audience. So hence why we are gathered here today, and yeah, so we're gonna try to tackle some of these topics, but in ways that don't get too high in the sky, too disconnected from life and experience. And to that end, we're gonna start with some personal stories that will evoke some of the themes that we will subsequently discuss. So,
Shall we jump in then?
I
And
say yes, sir.
Tandeka, you would like for us maybe to share stories of when we lost our sense of individual selfhood? Or how would you
No,
put it? How would you put it?
I will tell you my story first,
Okay.
and then you'll get a sense of what kind of story comes to mind that's similar to the one that I described.
Okay.
Here's my story. Several years ago, I attended a concert by the master violinist Isaac Stern, accompanied only by a pianist. I sat just a few rows back from the stage and eagerly awaited his entrance. When he entered, dressed in a formal black tuxedo with split tails, my immediate reaction disturbed me. The short, portly man looked like a penguin as he waddled across the stage to its center. I was deeply disturbed by this thought that he looks like a penguin. But I couldn't get it out of my mind. This man looks like a penguin. And then he started to play. He disappeared. As he continued to play, his violin disappeared. And then as he continued to play, I disappeared. That's my story.
Beautiful. Yeah. Music, as Jay said when we were talking recently, has a tendency to evoke these sorts of experiences. So I wouldn't be surprised if all of us have similar experiences in a musical context that have induced or coincided with these shifts of
Right,
experience too.
as I mentioned in our pre-conversation, I've told the story oh hundreds and hundreds of times and asked person to recall their stories. Some are with music, most of them are not. So what are your stories?
Yeah, one that came to mind for me to add a little variety is so Islam is the spiritual tradition that I'm most closely aligned with and practice, and I've definitely had this sort of experience in Islamic ritual practice where going through the bodily and verbal motions of prayer, things are happening. Body is moving, words are spoken, but it does not have this feeling of me as individual conscious agent intentionally doing something. It feels like being a part of and witnessing a float, and just being there and being centered in it, but no longer feels like me as actor, and all the better than in a communal context where you're moving, reciting together, and likewise, all the other individuals involved disappear in a certain sense, as you're describing it.
Wonderful. Jay?
I'll tell one that's different, although the experiences that you describe I can connect with, but mine will last only for 1 second, the experience I'm going to talk about. But I was the English teacher and student of a foreign of a Zen Buddhist priest when I was in school in Claremont, where you were, Tandeka. And I was deeply interested in enlightenment, the enlightenment experience. And I'd read all about it, and I was meditating, and I yearned for it, actually. I yearned for it, for a moment of awakening in which there'd be no self. And so one time we were sitting together in a kitchen, and he made me a cup of coffee. He loved coffee too. Probably made himself one too. And put it on the table in front of me. And I took a sip, and it was way too hot. And I said, "Ouch," something to that effect, "Ouch." And he said to me, "Jay, that's enlightenment." And his point was, in that moment of ouch, there was no separate Jay. There was actually no separate world. There was only the ouch. And so that will be my example of an experience in which a sense of no self happens. You don't will it into existence. You don't make it happen. It kind of just happens. And I kind of think it happens all the time, actually. I think in conversations with others, and I think no self happens a lot more than we know.
Well, this is wonderful because we agreed that after we told our stories, then each of us would explain using this example and this experience of what we mean by no thing or no self or nothingness. So I'll start. I found the experience so extraordinary. I started asking, telling persons my story. And asking if they had similar experiences. I said, tell me your Isaac Stern experience. First, I did this with individuals, and then I started gathering together small groups of people. And I did this hundreds and hundreds of times. And everyone had an Isaac Stern experience. I mean, one mother described watching her two young kids playing in the autumn leaves, and she said, everything was enveloped in love, and I entered into this altered state. Everyone had an experience. So, in the small groups, after we told our stories, listened to other stories, I would then say to the group, just shout out, what do you now feel? Free, cared for, loved, trusted. Enveloped. At this point, you would think that we were at a conference of mystics. So now I said, well, obviously there's something here that we have to explore, and I don't have to explain what it is because you've already experienced it. Let's see if we can understand it more deeply, because what we said about the experience, how we got into the experience, differs. But this feeling of connection, inextricably interwoven with all of life, not as a concept, but an actual experience in which we felt lost and fulfilled at the same time, is something that is apparently common to human experience. Even though we don't experience it very often, obviously we can because it's always there. So what is it? And I discovered initially three basic things. First, where it is. It's between concepts. It's between ideas. It's between emotions. It's between specific events. It's like the silence between two notes, or the pause between an inhalation and an exhalation, or the still point between the yo-yo going up and down. That space, which I think of as zero, I like the mathematical representation, zero, because it's the absence of magnitude or quantity. So where is it? It's between events. And one other point here, because with the brain, when the brain simultaneously triggers a physical response and a psychological or affective response to the same stimulus. And so it's between our sensations and emotions, this betweenness. So I figured out where it is. Then I wanted to know what is its content. Obviously, it's not ideas, because most of the people were not aware that they had Isaac Stern experiences that could be explained in by other people in their terms as well. So what is the content of this location? And again, I like the term zero because of the way it functions as a placeholder, as the absence of magnitude and quantity. It's like zero between minus one and positive one. It's that in-between space that never goes away. And so this in-between space, this contentless space, makes sense to me in terms of quantum physics as entanglements in which everything, non-events, they're together without any separation, which is why they're not part of this world. Although the entanglements themselves are not things. And so thus, this space, this emptiness, like the function zero, is not cognitive. And thus, Thomas Merton said, when he's in this state, he cannot, the mystic, he said he cannot even say there is a God, because that's a conceptual claim. So, where is it? Between experiences, between events, what is it? It's empty. Zero is the most functional word for me here when describing nothing. So it doesn't get abstruse. Zero is not abstruse. And then finally, why don't we experience this all the time? Since we're always moving between things from one concrete experience to another, similarly, in terms of causal efficacy, we're just flowing and we're moving in this way. We're going from one thing to another. Why don't we experience it all the time? And my answer is that it has something to do with trauma. Our ability to stay present to the fullness of life, to witness ourselves as a moment of creation, as part of life itself, as Friedrich Schleiermacher would say, the 19th century father of liberal theology, the experience of the infinite universe in a finite moment of my own life, which leaves the mind in a state of awe to be emptied of thought while the body is filled to overflowing. That coincidence of the emptiness and the fullness, that's what he located as foundational to religious experience without being religious experience, because religious experience is a cultural narrative. So, my third point, why don't we experience this all the time? I suspect that it is because most of us are in kind of a span of traumatic experiences through environmental injuries that prevent us from expanding and exploring our glorious experiences of being part of everything. So, those are my initial reflections on Maya Isaacstern experience.
There's so many directions we would take things at this point. I do want to get into some of the theological, metaphysical stuff, but I don't want to start there, especially in the context of bringing up this point about how trauma might be one of the reasons why, even as these experiences seem universal, they're somewhat uncommon in our lives. So maybe we should stay with this experience rather than moving away too quickly to the intellectual reflection. One of the ideas I've heard from cognitive science, which really kind of came up for me and I think has a strong connection here, is this notion of reciprocal opening, which I think is another kind of good way to describe the phenomenology of some of these experiences. The world appears more open, bigger, more pregnant with possibility, and I too in turn feel more able to engage and experience and take paths, but these are fully entangled and intertwined. And in terms of the trauma piece, a lot of how I'm hearing addiction talked about in these contexts is the exact opposite, reciprocal narrowing. The world and its possibilities seem smaller and more constrained. My what's relevant to me, my courses of action feel likewise tightened. That leapt out to me immediately when you were mentioning trauma in this context. It does feel like these difficult experiences that we all get in this life can very well have these constricting effects on ourselves and on the world we perceive and engage. How do we push back against that? How do we move towards, hopefully, these Isaacstern experiences, these reciprocal openings?
I'll add a different note, actually, because two things. One is, I actually think that the Isaac Ter Stern experience is happening all the time, concurrent with everyday experience, which includes its ups and its downs and its joys and its sorrows and its tensions and absence of tension. So I actually think there is as much Isaac Stern, that experience in a moment of pain, as in a moment of pleasure. And it's not necessarily between moments, it's also within moments. So that's point one. You can put it in Buddhist terms if you wish. You know, emptiness is form, but form is emptiness. It's let emptiness be the Isaac Stern experience, and form be the moment of pain or pleasure or whatever. They co-indwell. They are the same from two different points of view. That's point one. But here's point two, and this is something I wonder about. There was a time in my life when I was all about interconnectedness. and all about the idea that we should feel more connected and more healthily entangled with the surrounding world with a sense of kind of harmony and oneness. And the problem, I said, is the ego. That was my rhetoric. But I met somebody that had been abused by her husband rather terribly. And she heard me with my rhetoric of interconnectedness and transcending the ego and all that. And she said to me, Jay, you go transcend your ego. That's fine. You go enjoy that interconnectedness. That's fine. But what I need is more of an ego. I need to feel like an individual self because I felt like a nothing, a doormat for in the presence of my abuser. I did not have enough of an individualized self. And so the yearning to transcend the self, her point was, kind of depends on your social conditions and whether you have a self in the first place to transcend. And she was critiquing my universalization of interconnectedness and ego transcendence as the answer to all problems. She was basically saying, not mine. So I was wondering if what place does being and having an individual self different from others, not simply entangled, but unique. What place does that have in our Isaac Stern world?
I have two responses. Terrific. First, and again, I will start with a story to try to keep my comments grounded, because I believe we are exploring metaphysical and phenomenological issues, but without creating the fallacy of misplaced concreteness, thinking the ideas themselves are clearer than, well, I don't know, need to elaborate. Okay. First, the disposition. A couple of years ago, I went to a magnificent Beethoven concert in which there was a 100 voice choir singing, and a soloist as well, two or three soloists. The music was just enormously inspiring. So after the conference, I think I took the T home. I'm not sure. I could have flown. And when I arrived home, my agent had called, and she had just reviewed a manuscript for a new book. And she said, "You still have to work on chapter five or something. Needs a little more work before I send it off to a publisher." And I said, "Oh, okay, I'll work on it tomorrow." Before, if I had not first gone to the conference, the concert, I would have felt devastated because I worked so hard to get this thing ready and I was truly exhausted. But my disposition was still one of harmony and euphoric. So I look upon dispositions not as concepts or emotions, but the way in which triggered emotions and triggered sensations and triggered ideas are handled by the brain as an act of creating a particular way in which the organism is going to navigate the world. So I'm interested in dispositions, which is not a cognitive concept. It's an affective state that becomes the overarching protocol at a non-cognitive level for handling emotions. And a personal example of this in terms of my own spirit experience, even though I was raised in a perfectly wonderful middle-class family in Pleasantville, USA. Parents were brilliant, college-educated, graduate degrees, professionals, everything. I had everything a middle-class family could buy its middle-class kids. And I learned very early on that the only emotion I could express was to smile. So my senior year in college, before I went off to graduate school at Columbia University, one day I sat down and I swallowed 40 sleeping pills, aspirated, almost drowned in my vomit, rushed to the health center, afraid that I would drown in my vomit again. And because I had, when I received that first breath of air, clear air in my lung, I had this euphoric experience of being part of everything and loving life and feeling loved. So my stomach was pumped. I was sent off to a recovery room for the night, went home the next morning, washed the floors, the sheets, got rid of the vomit. Then I walked across campus and a classmate flagged me down and said, "You're always so happy. You're always smiling. Why are you so happy?" So I smiled even more broadly and moved on. So I'm talking about dispositions. True, to the point of the individual self. The question becomes, how does the neuropsychological studies, we track how the infant begins to develop a sense of selfhood. And Winnicott, some psychologists calls it, and others, this intermediate area of experience between the infant and the caregiver. And what's going on there informs the way in which the brain is developed, literally, and how the infant begins to have a sense of itself. So that if, for instance, as clinical psychologists discovered, when looking at the way in which mothers played with their infants, if whenever the infant turned away her head to take in the stimulation that had just happened to the brain and the body, if the mother would not let the infant turn away, but continue to track the infant instead of letting the infant's brain take in what had happened, 18 years late, 18 months later, that kid had developed mental problems. So the question for me becomes, at this level, how is with Isaac Stern, excuse me, Daniel Stern, the interpersonal world of the child clinical psychologist, how is the self of the infant neurologically developing lost, compromised, co-hut, exploded? Because the self is always a self-other, the self and the self-object. Thus, if the environment is compromised, lo and behold, the development of the self is compromised. And I agree with Kohut. Unlike with Freud, it's that the process for developing a fluid, open self is blocked, but if put in the right environment that's safe, the development will continue, which is why I'm so interested in small group work.
Yeah, this I mean I love how intimate and vulnerable sharing these experiences can be. And I think that I mean even in our adulthood, being able to have connection in that sort of way through these sorts of experiences absolutely contributes to yeah, continuing development and yeah, moving away from reactive trauma-based responses that certainly build up when we go through lives our lives with those types of experiences. Yeah, I was really liking what you were presenting with the self and other as always arising together, always implying the other. And I think that perhaps helps kind of establish a link between what Jay was saying and what else has been covered in this conversation, that there's always some kind of relation, and it can be a healthy relation, it can be a unhealthy relation, and we do want to have a certain quality to the betweenness of this self-other relation that has possibilities for settling into this you could say non-dual awareness or no thing type experience. But yeah, sometimes practical day-to-day life, you're going through life as a self in a world, experiencing others and environment as external, and it works well for what you need to do day to day. But you don't want to be trapped there. You don't want to feel stuck as always encountering others, especially in a restricted sort of way, getting caught in, oh, this is such and such a person, and that means they're going to treat me this way, or I need to respond that this other sort of way. So yeah, how can we allow some of those trauma responses to melt away, so there isn't such a stricture on some of the self-other relationships we experience in more
We have to
everyday
put the
consciousness.
brain in a safe space, a small group, a safe space, because then the brain will say, oh, okay, we're in a space, safe space now. And if the safety is experienced again and again, then we begin to remember ourselves literally. To put ourselves together because there aren't any memories there. I didn't know that I was an abused kid. I had everything money could buy. I was just so happy all the time. So we need small groups to discover what we do not even know we've lost because it's not an experience. It's not a permissible experience since we were raised in environments in which, in order to survive, we had to look upon our abusers as our saviors. The brain does that as a survival strategy, and only when we're in a safe space does the brain say, oh, okay, now maybe I can attend to some of these injuries. Because there are others who care for me and my well-being through compassionate understanding, grokking me, and that's enough.
I've really experienced this socially in discussions around self-esteem and mental health more generally. My millennial generation is more tuned in and a little more aware of this facet of our lives than many previous generations. But we're still figuring out how to kind of best work with all this material that we've inherited. Yeah, depression, anxieties, these sorts of things. But especially around self-esteem, one of the things that's gotten quite popular is this practice of affirmations, going about either out loud verbally or mentally telling yourself, I'm strong, I'm beautiful, I'm intelligent, these kinds of things. And some people do find some amount of help here. But I think a lot of people, it doesn't end up really being able to do this kind of work because they don't, you can tell yourself stuff all day, but if you don't feel safe, you don't actually have that experience, it doesn't register in the same way.
Tell
That
me how this experience I have makes sense to you. How does this translate into your generation's terms?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so needless to say, I went through a great many years of analysis and therapy, trying to figure out what was wrong with me because I was clueless. And I worked with a body therapist who just wanted to know what my body was doing, that how I held my body and, you know, how I moved, because that would indicate what was going on inside me emotionally. And so after several months, I said to her, gosh, our sessions must really be working, because I had a dream last night in which I was on the shore holding my head and pulling me out of a whirlpool into which I was being sucked into the ocean. And we struggled back and forth. I was in the ocean, I was on the shore. Was I going to go into the world, into that whirlpool? Was I going to go under, or was I going to pull myself onto the shore? And I said, I pulled myself onto the shore. And she said, no. She said, we're trying to get you to go into the whirlpool. That's where the memories begin.
Mm-hmm.
How does that translate to you and your generation?
Yeah, I mean, somewhat cliche phrase came to mind, but I think it's certainly apt. The only way out is through. And yeah, absolutely. I mean, simply trying to tell yourself sort of counterfactual narratives than the ones intuitively running through your head based on lived, embodied, social, real world experience, that it doesn't allow you to actually productively reprocess those things from a place of safety and agency. One of the other things I'm involved in, and is certainly very in vogue in my generation, is the psychedelic assisted psychotherapy modalities that are currently under investigation in various clinical trials. And some of how those therapies are theorized to effectively treat mental conditions is by inducing a state of neuroplasticity that allows for a sort of novel, safe re-engagement with traumatic experiences. And a major part of that, of course, is the effective sort of space holding of the therapist involved in this work. But yeah, that's totally the exact idea. Get yourself biochemically, socially in a prime setting, and then get into the whirlpool.
Yes,
it can be very
great.
Effective.
This is what I find so amazing about the psychedelic the approach. There was a long article in the New York Times several weeks ago. Well, September, August, something like that, 2004, that laid out, right, the controversies and the issues around this approach. And you're not old enough, perhaps you aren't old enough to remember Mad Magazine, although you might have heard of it. It was a crazy, crazy magazine that from beginning to end gaslit everything. With this character, Paul Newman, I can't remember his first name, Newman, right? But he was just mad, and he was just telling all these stories, and they were just off the wall crazy, right? Mad Magazine. Well, the article could have fit perfectly into a Mad Magazine volume, because it said things like, oh, well, the analysts also trip. And yes, there has been sexual abuse. And yes, a lot of people have been injured, on and on with the details. And then at the end, the reporter said, well, you know, but it's kind of worth a try. What I found most astonishing about the piece, other than the fact that it should have been a Mad Magazine instead of the New York Times, was that it was another example of not paying attention to the environment that abused the person that caused the trauma. Because that's systematically what is eliminated or ignored, because patients are treated as if their Pleasantville experiences are actually true. But therapists haven't, apparently, a great many of them have not been trained to track the trauma in its own terms, which requires attention to the environment that abused the kid. One other little story here. Should I tell it?
Go right ahead, please.
Alice Miller, in her book, her essay, A Drama of the Gifted Child, psychoanalyst, she said, "Huh, why are so many brilliant, highly successful persons ending up on my couch?" And here was her answer. Her patients, her clients, had been raised in environments in which their parents said, "We know you can do better. We know you can excel. We expect you to excel." So the kid would excel in order to be loved, but the parent would say, "Good job," instead of "Good you." So the kids felt ignored and not loved. Because again, what was praised was what they did instead of who they are. That's what's not being grappled with these days in most of our psychoanalytic and psychological tools. The environment that's crushing us, regardless of race, creed, class, gender, you name it. It's systemic.
Right. Yeah. I mean, even if the child is perfectly succeeding along these determined lines, it still is sending a signal of this is conditional. And
Right.
our nervous systems certainly pick up on that
That's right.
for
And we
sure.
feel fundamentally unloved. And that's the big secret, the big lie, which we carry forth in order to survive in a toxic environment. Does your generation know that?
I think we're getting more tuned in. Yeah, we're getting more tuned in, but I mean, it's hard. It's hard not yet having that many role models. People are trying to do all sorts of different things. But on a broader cultural level, we're still in the context of individualistic, capitalist, consumerist sorts of social organization. I mean, I'm a big fan of pluralism, but it's certainly a fragmentary pluralistic experience right now, whereas there have been social contexts where there was central spaces, the church, always imperfect, but you could go and there might be something there for community, for safety, for spiritual and deeply emotional experience. And there's just so many people that don't feel like there's an obvious place to turn at all for that sort of context. But we're
Well,
working on it.
emotional comfort and emotional safety, yes, which is why I'm so interested in small groups, because they become mini congregations, micro congregations, micro eco villages, 5 to 8 persons. We call them universal connections groups. And the series that we're producing called Untrolling America is showing how we got into this place and how we can get out of it, because our congregations are tanking because they aren't attending to the emotional needs and support of people in safe ways.
Maybe we should turn a little bit, in the interest of time, to spirituality and God and theology, just because we want the variation in what we talk about. So, Jared, I'm going to ask you a question to enter that world. Some in your generation, but I think you would be an example, exhibit a desire, maybe even a yearning, to reclaim tradition of one sort or another. But in your case, it's the Islamic tradition, and the rituals and the community and the deep history. Do you see much of that? I think question one is, do you see much of that around you, a desire to reclaim tradition? And how is that connected with the desire to be a whole person, a loved person, a person in community with others? Do you draw those connections yourself?
Yeah, that's a beautiful question. I feel like we're only kind of beginning to discuss this kind of more emotional, interpersonal side of this interesting cultural shift that very palpable in my generation. So certainly we have the nuns, Nones, as kind of the biggest growing spiritual affiliation, which is no spiritual or religious affiliation. But there is also a counter movement happening of people finding ignited interest in especially more traditional religious forms, Catholicism and Eastern Orthodoxy in the Christian world, especially. But you definitely see it in Islam and even Buddhism. People are more interested in, say,
Sangha,
a
not just
traditional,
meditation, but Sangha.
not just mindfulness, not just Buddhist teachings as kind of wisdom teachings, but being part of a Dzogchen lineage or the Soto school of Zen or something like this. And on a positive side, this can be a sort of move away from this kind of atomized individualism into participation in community, in a lineage that is beyond just the kind of temporal experience we find ourselves in right now. I think it can also, though, to the point of so much of what we've talked about so far, be a trauma response, grasping for an identity that is justified in such strong metaphysical, theological sorts of ways. I am saved because I am a part of this tradition, of this community. Where's that deep yearning coming from? That something beyond our immediate experience, beyond just who we are already, needs to be clung to as a justification. Look here, I am justified. I am saved. See, it's true. To Tondeika's point, like we need to have these safe contexts where, great, if you can point to your love and affinity for a tradition and have an attachment there, wonderful. But you being able to feel these this sense of justification, love, worthiness, organically, intrinsically, is even more foundational.
So let's talk about God. And I've had more than a few conversations with Tandeka, and she's a non-theist. And of course,
No, no.
what I was just going to add, of course, I'm going to let her speak for herself.
Right, but no, I'm not a non-theist. Yes. Thank you.
Okay, you're not a non-theist. So I think you're not a theist. Is that correct?
I don't use the three categories of theism: atheism, theism, and non-theist. I don't use those categories. It would be like saying, I don't have an there's an I don't have an elephant in my closet. You haven't a clue as to what is in my closet. So if you use any of those three terms in describing me, you haven't a clue as to what I'm actually saying.
Well, I don't mean to be clueless here, but what I do want to do is to open up a discussion of, I'll use the word God here, and nothingness. That's what I'm aiming at. And if God is not your word, find another word. It's fine. Ultimate reality is fine. You know, any term you choose is okay by me. But can we talk about the relationship between nothingness as a kind of personal experience, but actually nothingness as a metaphysical category, as the nature of the whole of it? And somehow link that with a question of religion or spirituality or God. That's what I'm asking us to do that in whatever way we're comfortable.
Terrific. Great. Here's the way that I am comfortable in answering your question, your wonderful question. I have experienced countless times. I've had countless Isaac Stern experiences of feeling inextricably interwoven with all of life. Or Schleiermacher, 19th century theologian, would put it, experiencing the infinite universe in a finite moment of my own life. Countless times, numerous times. With Schleiermacher, I say, the experience of being inextricably interwoven with all of life, experiencing myself as part of the interdependent web of life, is an affective, emotional experience in which my body is literally filled to overflowing. It's William James's perforated edges of consciousness, just filled to overflowing with all of life, not figuratively, but literally. And then Schleiermacher said, huh. So what's the mind doing when the body is filled to overflowing with the manifest of the universe? The mind is not thinking. It is empty of thought. The null point of consciousness, he called it, the null point of thinking. So the mind, the body is filled with all of life, literally. Overflowing, Isaac Stern's experiences. The mind is empty of thought. No thought is present, which is why Isaac Thomas Merton, Trappist monk in the States, says, I can't even say there's a God because that's a cognitive claim. And Schleiermacher says, okay, these two experiences, no thought, empty of thought, and infinite fullness. Are two aspects of the same experience. Their meeting point is not feeling or thought, but he called the in-between emptiness. And it's here that Buber and Merton and Schleiermacher and Dilthey and D.W. Winnicott and so many others point to as the birthplace of religion, but not a religious experience, because all religious experiences, Schleiermacher, are cultural constructions and narratives. Whereas the feeling, the experience of being inextricably interwoven with all of life and the mind, the state of awe, is constitutive of being human. Thus, what's said about it defines a person's individual experiences and cultural traditions, which creates a religious narrative or spiritual narrative. That to which it refers is not a cultural construction. And thus, when Schleiermacher was asked, as the father of modern liberal theology, well, what's your definition of God? He said, I can't give you a definition of God. That's a cultural, that would be imposing my way of thinking on projection, would be projection. So the only thing I can say, if you insist upon me having a doctrine of God, is to tell you how I feel when I feel inextricably interwoven with all of life, or the feeling of absolute dependence, which is love. Or as Martin Buber said, when you Hasidic scholar and theologian, philosopher, said, When you are in the presence of God, God is not defined. You are.
Jared, do you want to pick up on that?
Yeah, absolutely. The quote from Martin Buber that you just shared reminds me of something similar that the Japanese philosopher of the 20th century, Keiji Nishitani, certainly a big voice in the discourse on nothingness, also said, in terms of defining religion, he says, you cannot give an account of what religion is as if it is some thing or sphere that has a utility for human beings, but rather, it is exactly this phenomena where we as human beings ourselves come under question. That is how he begins his exploration of this idea of nothingness, no thingness, shunyata in the Sanskrit. Yeah, one of the topics that kind of initially spurred our idea for a discussion was this idea of creation and how many process theists tend to reject this traditional doctrine of creatio ex nihilo, creation out of nothing. But I was wondering, perhaps if we are following Schleiermacher, refusing to thingify God and in our theologizing, understand God as no thing. Perhaps there, the distinction between creatio ex nihilo and an alternative conception, creatio ex Deo, creation out of God, God's self, perhaps these kind of fuse together. We can find some reconciliation there. So this is a provocative idea I've had. I'd be interested in your thoughts, but also interested in terms of how creation and creativity plays into everything we've been talking about so far in terms of the experience, these Isaac Stern moments, and
I want to jump
getting
in.
Beyond the trauma.
I'd like to get a word in here, a process word,
please.
Just so that can be part of the discussion. If you take a look, if you read part five of Process and Reality, and you read what Whitehead described as what he called the consequent nature of God, for him, rightly or wrongly, it involved a sense of what he called an eternal companion. And the word he uses is companion. So it's a sense, in a way, of being loved with tender care. That's also his phrase, with tender care that nothing be lost. And I want to personally, I want to honor that experience as a legitimate religious experience. And sometimes when I hear people talking about nothingness and emptiness and shunyata, I kind of get that. But it doesn't seem to me to be the whole of human religious life. If you look at kind of the totality of the history of religion, it has involved interchange between people and gods in a kind of healthy way and unhealthy way, depending on how you define it, a kind of sense of a dialogical relationship, or to put it in Buber's terms, an I-thou relationship with God as the eternal thou. So my question is, does that have a place also in your understanding of genuine religion? And by the way, I have to acknowledge I find the word religion problematic. So I'm kind of not on board because I think it's a Western word and has countless meanings, and it doesn't actually touch so many aspects of Asian, East Asian and South Asian and in indigenous ways. So I don't, that's not my word, but I'm willing to use it here in the history of religion. What do you make of those I-thou connections? I think Whitehead felt that. with this sense of a great companion, a tender care that nothing be lost. Does that have a place? All right, end of
Yes,
me.
3 points. First, to go back to Nishitani and his book, Religion and Nothingness. As a Buddhist, he said, I'm going to continue the investigation of nothingness because Westerners can only go so far because they don't understand shunyata, emptiness. They, in this way, are creating the fallacy of misplaced concreteness by treating nothingness as an idea as opposed to the experience of the falling away of the constructed self. And so, thus, what we have to do, Kensho, is to see what has been blocked off. So Nishitani and the Kyoto school of Buddhism used Western concepts, okay, Heidegger and others, to push beyond the blockage of the Western mind and its inability to move beyond concepts into the actual experience of feeling inextricably codependent origination. Whitehead. As Whitehead says in part five of Process and Reality, he says, oh, by the way, when I talk about God, it's not because you will not be able to find a cognitive link between the first part of my book and my discussion of God. That's right, Whitehead, it isn't. You don't find it there. And so, thus, again, I reaffirm Schleiermacher and Cantwell Smith in the beginning and end of Religion, and how religion was invented by Schleiermacher as a way of explaining how specific communities and individuals reflect upon the experience of being feeling inextricably interwoven with all of love of life. And then he defined religion as the cognitive descriptions and reflections on that experience, which have their own social history and personal biographies. So, which he, and thus he made the distinction between that and simply feeling inextricably interwoven with all of life, which is not a cognitive claim, experience. So when Whitehead says, yes, companionship, yes, that's Whitehead using his Christian theistic background to explain what and the cognitive nature of God, to explain in theistic terms what he has not demonstrated metaphysically. And the need for that
I don't
is
really agree with
present.
you on Whitehead, but it's okay. It's okay.
But he did say, right? He did say you cannot get from part one of and two of my book to the end of it and
I don't
find a
remember where he says that. You'll send me the page. But I
sure.
think my more general question is, the Kyoto school was very much influenced by Zen, and I'm trained in Zen myself, and my PhD dissertation dealt with Nishitani, so I know that literature pretty well. But I also know that in Buddhism as practiced in Japan and in China, it's really the Pure Land traditions that are by all means the most popular. For good or ill, it's the Pure Land traditions that speak of celestial bodhisattvas with whom you have a relationship. And I think that is kind of a little bit in the spirit of Whitehead's notion of a great companion. They're in the same family. And I just want to say, is there a connection? Should we say of those people, if you really understood, if you really understood, you would realize that that's a social construct of your imagination, and the ultimate reality is the inextricable entanglement of all things in one another, if you really had your head on straight. Or by contrast, should we say, that's part of paticca-samutpada too. That's part of the interconnected web of life too. You go with that if that's
I
where
would
you
find it
are. I
arrogant.
think that's where Whitehead is.
I would find it arrogant to say of another person's spiritual experience or religious claims that, oh, if you only understood this a different way, then
Yeah.
you'd have this agreement. I mean, the
That's
British tried to set
what
this
I'm
up,
resisting
and
myself.
that's
That's what I'm
what the
resisting.
yes, but we are at this point not trying to convert each other's to each other's perspectives, but rather trying to understand them. And for me, Theravada Buddhism is particularly attractive because of its three levels definitions of morality. Its first definition of morality is the golden rule: do unto others as you would like them to do unto you. Okay, they say that's all right, but it's pretty selfish, isn't it? The second level is do it because it makes you feel good. There's that self again. The third level is your very nature is compassionate. Your very nature is compassion. And that's a disposition that is enormously wise, such that even in the midst of pain and suffering, you say, forgive them, for they know not what they do. I simply don't make the assumption that because, billions of people do not use the term or refer to the term God in their own language or whatever, I don't make the assumption that that's a universal claim, but rather accept it as a universal claim of people who say it's universal. I say, okay.
So be it. Jared, what do you think? Do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean
I'm trying to
it's
make space for Amida Buddha.
I think Amida Buddha is making space for us, perhaps. I think that's perhaps how it works.
I got it.
Great. Oh, good. That's good news for you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Do we want to talk about music before we close?
Certainly.
Sandeka, you have marvelous insights concerning the nature of music. Would you share some of them?
Thank you. Yes. Thank you. Yes. And before we move there, just a slight note here, which is that I'm a Unitarian Universalist minister and theologian. And as you know, everyone, all kinds of persons are in the Unitarian Universalist tradition, theists and non-theists, all kinds of people. So we try to make space for all of us. That was just a little footnote. Music. I have a favorite story of, and so thus do not want to in any way offend or seem to make assumptions about others' religious claims. That's not my goal at all. And if I have done that, I certainly apologize. I simply want try to explain how I've come to understand the differences in religious claims and spiritual claims without trying to reduce them to some common denominator, conceptual denominator. Music. I love talking about music because of an experience that neuroscientists did with baby chicks. Jacques Panksepp, the founder of the brain science of emotions, affective neuroscience. I worked with him. He was a consultant of mine for 10 years. He was kind enough to be a consultant and a friend for 10 years before he died. So anyway, he took a group of baby chicks, separated them from their mothers, put them in a cage by themselves, and the baby chicks went into separation distress, moving their little heads back and forth and flapping their little wings, indicating separation distress. He and his teammate wanted to test the theory, which is that emotions are triggered by the brain through a particular kind of molecular activity. So it will trigger happiness or sadness or fear or rage or anxiety because of certain molecular patterns. So they thought if we could find the molecular structure for lowering separation distress, such that the music had that patterning principle, would we eliminate the separation distress in the baby chicks? So they found the rhythmic pattern that was akin to the rhythmic pattern of the molecular structure that triggers relief. And they piped the music into the cage, and the separation of stress among the baby chicks was gone. They concluded that music evokes chills and wistful sense of hopefulness in human beings because of the structure of being reaffirmed at a affective, neurological, neurochemical level of being safe and held and healed. So then the question became for me, well, did the baby chicks have a religious experience? And Schleiermacher would say, well, no, actually, they just had their separation distress lowered. A religious experience is the use of reflection and tradition, new or handed down, to not only explain what has just occurred, the liturgy, the change in feeling, but to extend it. So, music at a neurological level triggers emotional states.
Jared.
Make tracks really well with my own experience as a musician. I mean, another story I could have told at the outset was performing in the wind band that I was a part of during my college years. And yeah, certainly some intensive experiences across the emotional spectrum. We played some really phenomenal pieces. The one that will stick with me most deeply for life is definitely David Maslanka's A Child's Garden of Dreams, which is a modern composition based off of an account from Carl Jung's Red Book of a patient he had who's, I think the patient actually was the daughter of someone, but this young girl reported a series of very intensive, initiatory, symbolically rich dreams before pretty suddenly passing away from a rare disease at a young age. And so it to me that piece of music is the most robust theodicy I've ever encountered. Because yeah, you get to accompany this child's preparation for death through a musical rendition of religious experiences, basically.
Could you
So
describe one of those experiences in more detail? You weren't expecting it, but something happened. Could you describe what happened?
it's it can certainly be
For you,
as
right.
yes, yeah, a sort of intensive flow state. I mean, we get the flow state doing all sorts of things, but here it's not just, oh, I'm kind of in the zone, but you are member of this larger organism, this larger beauty making symphony. And the experience of playing and performing definitely no longer has this individual quality to it of, again, agent action sort of thing. You are pulled along as much as you are pushing things forward. And
Is it like the music is playing you instead of you are playing the
yeah, it
music?
definitely can be. But the full range of kind of emotional experience can be there in the midst of that. I mean, there was times that I had tears in my eyes performing this music. So it wasn't like I was, I mean, a lot of flow state, it's just, oh, there's pure concentration, pure
Right. But
sort of
that's the baby
focus.
chick story. You're triggering emotions in you. Your brain.
I wonder if music is also a kind of ontology, and here's what I mean. On Christmas Eve, I always listen to the music at St. John of the Divine Cathedral in New York City. And they always bring in a local opera singer, it's typically the same person, to sing O Holy Night toward the end.
Wow.
And it's got an orchestra and it's got a choir, and they build up and build, she builds up and builds up and builds up. And you know it in the last verse or there around, she hits that really high note. And I remember feeling that, hearing that, and feeling this is so beautiful. This is so beautiful that it kind of transcends all suffering. It transcends all suffering. There's something so beautiful that it transcends suffering. And you can deal with anything in your life if you know that beauty. And so that's a kind of ontology, if you see what I mean. That's a kind of revelation of something about the nature of things. Something about the nature of things. I have a feeling there's all kinds of things to learn about the nature of things. One of them is that kind of beauty. Also, music can reveal suffering in actually wonderful ways, and joy. But Tandeka, in Why Does Philosophy, feeling is everything, because the actual occasions of experience of which the universe is composed consist of prehensions, and prehensions are feelings. And they have something called subjective forms, and he calls those emotional tones that clothe feelings. So that means everything we see and touch and feel is an aggregate expression of feeling, one way or the other. So music, I think, is what feelings sound like.
Literally.
And yeah,
Baby chicks, literally.
literally.
Not as a metaphor,
No,
literally.
I mean literally too. Literally too, not metaphorical. So.
Yes, I mean, amen to what you said, amen to that, amen to that. And yes, I mean, as John Cobb Jr. said, process studies is a philosophy of emotions.
Yeah, it is.
And Whitehead was interested in what the brain does.
It was.
And he wrote Science in the Modern World because he noted that the Western tradition had been ignoring emotions, causal efficacy, et cetera, et
True.
cetera. Yes, so yes, absolutely amen to what you're saying.
And he wanted to rewrite Kant as a critique of pure feeling. I mean, that's one of the things he says. Would that Kant would have written a book called The Critique of Pure Feeling, not just The Critique of Pure Reason. That was
Yes.
a quip, but it was a wise quip.
Yes. And I went to Schleiermacher
Yeah.
from Kant because Schleiermacher actually wrote the text.
Yes, he did.
And he said of Kant's second critique of critical reasoning, that practical reason, he said that Kant had fallen away from his own insights by failing to take into account what the nervous system does.
It kind of brings the body back into things.
Literally,
And
literally.
Whitehead had a phrase, the withness of the body, Withness.
Yes.
Wherever we go, our body is with us. And we are always with our body. It kind of, it's the place
Yes, wherever our
where we meet
body
life.
goes, yes, wherever our body goes, we are with it.
That's right.
Or
It can
at a
go either
certain
way.
point, and I know you know this, Jay, Jared, as well. At a certain point, you're in the middle of the night and you're working on something and you don't want to stop. You're really on to something, and the body will say, continue without me.
That's
Okay, I'll
good.
go to bed
No,
now. Carry on, I'm going
that's good.
to
That's good. That's good.
bed. Okay. Universal connections. are small groups, 5 to 8 people, sometimes even smaller, that meet weekly for 2 hours or less if the group decides, in which they have a formal, informal check-in. What's going on with me? How do I feel? These groups allow people a chance to simply be themselves and feel safe and heard rather than judged. So we've created universal connections, small groups, and are inviting as many people as possible to go to our website, universalconnections.word, word, world, universalconnections.world, to sign up for these groups so that you too have a safe space to rediscover and reaffirm your whole self with others, because we are truly communal beings. And Untrolling America is a 10-part multimedia series in which we track how we lost ourselves environmentally, in terms of our environment, our home environment, in terms of our history, and how we can retrieve it. I think of this kind of a Sesame Street for adults. As a kid, when you watch Sesame Street, you learned how to read, and you had a good time doing it because you didn't watch it because you wanted to learn how to read. You just were entertained. Similarly, in Untrolling America, you watch it because it's the series are compelling. I'm an Emmy Award-winning television producer, so we're constructing these so that it's a narrative from beginning to end. My story's in it, your story's in it. And as you watch the series, you begin to reflect upon your own experiences and have aha moments. So in this way, the series itself teaches, if you will, emotional literacy and leads into, we hope, your desire to form a small group to continue the work. So that we think of it as a grassroots initiative, both of these programs as a grassroots initiative to heal ourselves and Mother Earth.
Wonderful. And we'll have links to all those things in the description, so you can definitely follow up, especially if you want to, yeah, experience personally some of these kind of small group safe spaces that we've been talking about in this conversation. So
Thank you. And if you want to donate funds toward our production of the Untrolling America, please feel free to do so, because we want to produce these in a way such that it's absolutely compelling, if you will, television video.
wonderful. Well, Tandeka, it was wonderful talking to you. I feel like we co covered some really novel and evocative territory, both personally and intellectually, in this conversation. So thank you for being on with us.
Thank you so much for the invitation, and it's always a pleasure to be in conversation with you. Thank you so
Likewise.
much, Jan.
All right. Have a good day.
You
Enjoy
too.
the meeting.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you.